to another episode of A Push Anxiety Attack. If you enjoy this show, please remember to review us on whatever podcatcher you use. You can also now listen to us on YouTube, where you get to enjoy my dulcet tones while staring at Richard Nixon's smiling face. So, at Lexington and Concord, we literally have shots fired, and the British Army became bottled up in Boston. The area around the city became flooded with militia intent on joining in the conflict, and everybody was getting very excited. However, getting a military force out of a defended position in this period required cannon, and it required the time to starve your opponent out. The militia didn't have any heavy weapons to blast their way in, and they certainly didn't have the ability to stop the British being supplied by sea. I mean, this is Boston. Meanwhile, the Second Continental Congress were meeting in May 1775. Last time we checked in, they were going to meet in 1775, the year later, and see if relations between the colonies and the mother country had improved. It's pretty safe to say they had not. Initially, we can see that these are similar or the same people who'd met the year before. In general, they're a pretty conservative bunch, and they're not there to do anything rash. They're not there to talk about revolution or breaking away from the king. They're there to discuss continuing the politics from last year to achieve the status of full citizens of the crown. However, the events of Lexington and Concord arrive like an explosion. This changes everything. Now, they're not unhappy colonists. Now the British government is going to view them as rebels. Colonists have opened fire on British troops. Still, there isn't a vote for rebellion at this point. Most of the voices in Congress are still trying to work out how to make this work and stabilise their relationship with the king, while also using these events to their advantage. So, what is their plan? Well, excitingly, they're going to send another list of grievances to the king, making it really clear how very, very serious they are this time. But they're also going to raise funds to equip an army and dig up one of the only men in the colonies with military command experience, George Washington, to command it. Now, Washington is an interesting choice. He's never risen higher than a colonel of militia. He was a colonel during the Seven Years' War, and he actually tried to get a commission in the British Army, but they weren't interested in him. In fact, as far as you know, the only major operation he'd commanded was a complete disaster. But at least he looked the part. He had military experience, he was very tall and authoritative, and he made the colonists feel like they could trust him. He also had a reputation for good character. He was seen as patient and brave. There was a growing myth about him the moment his name was raised. He agreed to serve for no pay, though it's worth noting he did keep an expense account that ran into quite a considerable amount. So now we see opinions in Congress swing back and forth. On one hand, these men saw themselves as British and were still hoping to re-establish good relationships with the king. They're still swearing loyalty to him while also taking up arms against the crown. This leads to an awkward situation. You know, we're at war with you, but only until you love us again and agree to our terms. Then we'll go back to being your subjects. Very quickly, the war begins to gain momentum. In May, Ethan Allen and Benedict Arnold lead a group known as the Green Mountain Boys in Vermont in a series of victories all over the north, most notably Fort Ticonderoga and Crown Point. It's really hard to express how important these initial victories are. They succeed in capturing cannon and gunpowder. These are military technology that is very hard to acquire if you're not a major power like Britain or France. The colonies do not have the ability to make these for themselves. As we mentioned before, these are the very technology they'll need to resolve the Boston situation. But they also need to bring the cannon down to Boston, and this is an incredible feat in its own right. They have to drag those heavy cannons south on almost impassable roads. Remember, we talked about how bad the roads were. But when they do get them to Boston, they're a serious threat to the British. By June 1775, they have these cannon established on a series of hills overlooking Boston. This is now a huge threat to the British. They can attack their troops in the city, and they can also threaten supply ships coming into the harbour. One of the hills is called Bunker Hill, and it overlooked the entire city. The British, seeing this being established, had to launch an attack on Bunker Hill. Now, there are several ideas underpinning this plan. The British believe the hill is held by a bunch of farmers who will not be able to stand against British troops in a determined assault. So they launch a frontal assault up Bunker Hill. Let that sink in. Their strategy is to run at the line of defences up a hill, straight ahead towards them. This plan only works if their ideas about the colonial forces are correct. The technology at this time is the smoothbore musket. This weapon needs to be reloaded after each shot, and the time it takes to reload is the key factor in much of this combat. A well-trained soldier can fire around 4 to 5 bullets a minute, but if they're poorly trained farmers, they might only get 1, maybe 2 off, allowing the British to reach them with only a few casualties. But instead, we have to remember that many of these troops have previously served with the British. It's only 12 years since the colonials were fighting alongside them against the French. These colonists have been drilling and practicing in case this happened, and they're able to pour fast, well-aimed volleys into the British, causing terrible casualties. Now, they do have to eventually give up the high ground, so this is a technical victory for the British, but the colonial militia have proved that they will not just collapse when faced by the professional army, as long as they're defending an entrenched position against a frontal assault. However, despite this, Congress is still trying to make peace. They send a thing called the Olive Branch Petition to the king, saying essentially, listen, it doesn't have to be like this. We'd happily lay down our arms if you just respond to, you know, all those lists of grievances we've been sending you. But after Bunker Hill, King George basically decides there's no way he's going to go along with that. Now he needs to bring these colonists to heel. It's worth remembering that the British army spread out around all their territories, guarding against threats from the French and Spanish. They really don't have a lot of soldiers to use suppressing this uprising. So George is going to blow his budget because, as we've noticed in previous episodes, he's got a lot of spare cash floating around to hire a bunch of mercenaries from the various German kingdoms. Many of the rulers of these are all his relatives, and they are often known as Hessians, as a generic term, though only some of them come from the Kingdom of Hesse. The next obvious move for the colonials is to attack Canada. Now, that might seem ambitious, but it's a logical move if you think about it. The border isn't that far from the main area of conflict, and it makes sense to take the fight to your enemy rather than fighting in your own territories. Also, the British were under the assumption that by moving into Canada, the French Canadians would rise up to join them. After all, they'd only been under British rule for a little over a decade after being defeated at war. Surely, they must hate the British. However, the assumption is fundamentally flawed. The French Canadians had actually been treated pretty well by the British. They'd been allowed to keep many of their old traditions, while, if anything, having more freedoms under British rule than they'd had under the French. This also fundamentally undermined something the American colonists had been able to argue, that they were somehow fighting to defend and liberate their own lands. The French Canadians instead saw them as the invaders coming to force their ways on them. So instead of having that imagined moment of being greeted as liberators, the American colonists found themselves fighting against the Canadian colonists, not what they had signed up for. The Americans lose quite badly here, and much of that is not against the British army, but against local colonial militias. Benedict Arnold and his men are defeated at Lake Champlain and sent back south in a scattered mess. After that, events continue to progress quite rapidly. In January of 1776, the British army take Norfolk, Virginia and burn it, and back in the north they pull out to Boston in March, and while this is celebrated in Boston as a great victory, the reality is that the moment the large cannons arrived, it was smarter for the British to pull their troops out to Canada and use their incredible sea power to strike anywhere in the colonies. They're no longer pinned down in one place, the colonists obviously don't have much of a navy, and now they have no idea where the British will appear any day. The colonists win a couple of small battles, one at Morkeek Bridge in North Carolina. This one's worth noticing because there were no British troops involved. The colonial rebels are fighting 1,500 colonial loyalists. Then they beat off a naval assault on Charleston Harbor. The events here were making a larger amount of American colonists reconsider their loyalty to the king. And the big bombshell is the publication and mass printing of Thomas Paine's pamphlet, Common Sense. Thomas Paine is an incredibly interesting character. He's a very vocal supporter of American independence, and his work is very, very readable. It's in very common, regular, plain language. And it argues that the physical body, you know, in the physical world, a smaller body can never effectively govern or control a larger body. And the reason the king had overstepped his authority were plainly laid out in the book. Any colonist could pick it up, easily read it, and discuss it with others. And it's radical in two ways. Firstly, it called for independence in North America. A and secondly, it called for the establishment of a republic once they had become independent, something not previously successfully seen since the Republic of Rome. A republic, in case we're unclear, distinct from a direct democracy, is a government where the people elect representatives to then get together and make decisions for them. And this places the power within the people rather than a divinely appointed king where power is granted him by God. While Britain did have elements of democracy this time, it was a monarchy that just allowed a parliament to make laws for it. In a republic, the entire system would be appointed and controlled by the people. Radical stuff at the time. Americans, especially New England and Virginia, had been practicing some manner of self-government for generations in their local houses of burgess, so this was kind of a natural expansion of that for them. On the other hand, many Americans were pretty sceptical about this idea. The idea of turning power over to the people seemed very dangerous. Remember, the majority of people attending the Continental Congress were wealthy and educated. They tended to be much more conservative about where power should lie. They felt the majority of people were certainly not qualified to make these decisions and should leave decision-making to the right sort of people. You know, them. Enter onto the scene one of them, Thomas Jefferson. Now, before we go any further, it is important to make clear that Thomas Jefferson's declaration did not make America independent, nor was it even the document that made that process formal. The Continental Congress began to move towards independence, and it was Richard Henry Lee, from one of the most powerful families in Virginia, who proposed a motion before Congress for it. This is known as the Lee Resolution, and it was one of the most important things in American history that nobody knows about. It was passed in July 2nd, 1776, and it decided, once and for all, that the colonies, as represented at the convention, wanted independence. This is the actual document that made America. It was the legal statement that they were now independent. What the Congress asked Thomas Jefferson to write was the accompanying explanation. The Declaration of Independence is the note along with it that says, "And here's why." We can think of it in terms of breaking up with a partner. You're going to say, "I don't think we should see each other anymore," and then you're probably going to say, "And here's why." This declaration is written in deep, philosophical language. This isn't Thomas Paine, and he's drawing specifically on a number of Enlightenment philosophers to explain his reasoning. The declaration breaks down into four clear parts. There's a preamble, a statement of rights, a list of grievances, and a statement of separation. Now, the preamble is the true breakup letter, and it makes it clear that it isn't something the colonists wanted to do. It's not something that even they're choosing to do. It's just become necessary to do it. It's not you, it's not me, you know, it's just not working out. It's not healthy for either of us to continue. Then comes the statement of rights. This is very much lifted from the work of John Locke. He was the philosopher that really promoted the concept of inalienable rights. Literally, rights you cannot be made alien from, meaning they cannot be removed. Locke's three were life, liberty, and property. Jefferson is going to finally settle on life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, which is probably a good move for someone who literally owned human beings as his property. It also suggested that all men are created equal. So that's a thing. Then, the list of grievances make it clear all the things the king has done that Congress doesn't like. And it's actually, you know, it's really you, and here's why. Notably in this list is blame for introducing slavery to the colonies, which is, to put it mildly, a bit rich coming from Jefferson. The Lee Resolution and the Declaration essentially place the colonies legally into the position of rebellion. The die has been cast, and if they lose the war, they are now likely to also lose their heads. America was by no means united on this, and we can generally break them to four groups. We have a group we can describe as patriots or, you know, hardcore rebels. These are also known at the time as the Whigs, after the British political party that seemed to share some of the ideas with them. And these are probably somewhere between 10 to 20% of the population. Around another 10 to 20% of the population can be described as loyalists or Tories, again based on a British political party. These are ones who very strongly believe that they should not break with the king. Moderates are in the middle and are by far the largest group. These might have some sympathy with the rebels, but still weren't about to take up arms. Common sense did move many of these into the rebel cause. And then you have a solid block that can be described as just apathetic, who didn't think politics had any impact on their lives and didn't care either way. Most notably in this group were profiteers, who were happy to trade to both sides and make money along the way. Throughout most of the war, we can say the British had a powerful military, but could only really take and hold land along the coastal regions, while the colonial troops were most secure in the inland areas, safe from the Royal Navy. It was very difficult for the British to supply their forces inland, and easy for the rebels to harass them and to hit-and-run tactics. In fact, throughout the war, a clear trend emerged that would be familiar to students of American wars in the last 70 years. The British could control territory for as long as their soldiers were there, but the moment they left, the area reverted to rebel hands. So, let's take a moment to go back and think about those loyalists. Most of the very motivated loyalists were from quite wealthy families, although in some cases, families were split. One of Benjamin Franklin's sons served as royal governor in New Jersey and fought against a rebellion. They tended to be stronger and more common in the South, where the Church of England was more popular, but less common in the North, where other denominations were powerful. They also tended to be concentrated in ports and coastal areas where connections to Britain were strongest, with the notable exception of that hotbed of trouble, Boston. Prior to the Declaration, they tended to experience harassment, a bit of mockery, resentment, and occasional acts of terrorist violence such as beatings or tarring and feathering. However, after the Declaration, many were imprisoned, attacked, homes were burned, some were just hung. Around 80,000 left early in the war, leaving much of their belongings behind, which were confiscated and sold to pay for the war effort, or just stolen by locals. An estimated 50,000 served with the British against a rebellion. Some others served as spies or worked to get native tribes to fight for the British, though there was always suspicion towards them from the British army. Generally, the British were inclined to see all the colonists as kind of untrustworthy. After pulling out of Boston, the British turned their attention to New York City. A large British navy carrying an army arrived in that harbour. Newly appointed commander of the Continental Army, George Washington, had predicted this. It was the obvious target, and he had 18,000 men in position. However, these troops are not able to hold against the professional British soldiers. Washington's men were pushed off Long Island and only avoided total capture when a fog bank rolled in and protected their escape. From there, Washington was pursued across Manhattan and had to retreat into New Jersey. Finally, they set up camp along the Delaware River in Pennsylvania. Things looked bad. Washington refused to let the British rest, however, and on December 26, a small force crossed the Delaware at night and raided a camp of British mercenaries while they were celebrating Christmas. This is seen as a key battle, but it was a very small fight at Trenton. However, it had an important significance in terms of colonial morale. It was seen as their first victory. The Continental Army under Washington had lost every battle up to this point. 1 week later, Washington won a much more significant victory at Princeton and began to turn the idea that the colonials couldn't win battles around. Despite losing almost every battle in 1776, they hadn't lost the war. All they had to do was not lose. The British had to defeat them. They didn't have to defeat the British. During this winter, and in light of Washington's forces, London came up with a new plan to defeat the colonials, and this was more complex and took into account the understanding of this new organised and effective enemy. The focus was to be New England, and the plan had three parts. One group of soldiers would move down from Lake Erie eastward along the Mohawk River. Another group would move south from Montreal along Lake Champlain, and the very significant General Howe would bring men north from New York. The plan would isolate New England from the rest of the colonies, with all three of these forces converging on Albany. On paper, this is a great plan. However, it runs into problems in reality. The first is Benedict Arnold. His men had not completely left the area after their fighting in 1776. The British forces, trying to take Lake Champlain, had to deal with a fleet of ships that Arnold had put together practically out of nowhere. The British had to spend time to remove this threat from the lake, and this delayed the forces coming down from Montreal. The second problem was terrain. It's very easy to draw lines on a map, but marching thousands of soldiers through upstate New York when there are almost no roads as the winter snow melts is, well, if you've ever been in upstate New York when the snow melts, you can imagine the challenges. To say the British got bogged down would be a huge understatement. The next problem is much more straightforward. The group moving from Lake Erie ran into a combined force of colonial militia and Oneida troops and got beaten at the Battle of Oriskany. These forces were completely turned back. So, one third of the force is delayed, one is defeated. How's the other third of the plan going, General Howe? Well, here, the issue is that General Howe has his own plan. His plan, which is probably not bad in its own right, but completely ignores the orders from home, is to head south using the Navy, which, by the way, his brother is in charge of. He then is able to threaten Philadelphia, which is currently the closest thing the colonies have to a capital. Howe beats Washington in two battles, then sweeps up towards Philadelphia, forcing the Congress to run away. The retreating colonial army ends up spending an incredibly rough winter in Valley Forge, though defeated and almost entirely out of supplies. The significance of this winter is probably less about the mythology of the poor colonial freezing at Valley Forge, and more about the arrival of a bunch of advisors hired by colonial representatives in Europe. Notably, a man among them is called Baron von Steuben. He's an amazing character. He's Prussian, and he passes himself off as a high-ranking officer in the Prussian military, despite being neither A, a baron, or B, having risen higher than a captain in the Prussian army. He had, however, been trained in drilling troops, and turned out to be very, very good at that job. He's one of the men responsible, more than anything else, from turning a motley mess that Washington fought with for the first year of the Revolution into a much better organized and disciplined army. The British army, on the other hand, spent the winter in Philadelphia, but they seemed to have got a bit too comfy. Benjamin Franklin joked that Howe hadn't captured Philadelphia, Philadelphia had captured Howe, because come the spring, the British didn't seem to want to move. But while Washington and Howe stayed put in Pennsylvania, events in New York State were again going to be important. Remember New York, Howe? Weren't you supposed to be meeting someone in New York? Yet those 7,000 troops from Montreal that had struggled through Lake Champlain, they were still marching south. Who knows? Maybe they're still expected to meet up with Howe in New York. They don't meet Howe, though. They meet Benedict Arnold again, with at least twice as many soldiers as them. After some initial fighting, where more and more colonial troops kept showing up, the British soldiers finally decided there was no choice but to surrender. They were literally outnumbered 2-1 by that point. It's a dramatic turning point in the war. This is a striking and undeniable victory. All of Washington's battles in the South look insignificant next to this one. Saratoga showed the world the British military could be defeated cleanly in the field, albeit when massively outnumbered. This was a huge boost to colonial morale, but probably more importantly, it showed other countries around the world that the colonists might be able to actually win this. Now, which other countries? Well, really one country, France. Remember last episode, we discussed how Britain and France had basically been permanently at war with each other, and this was proof to the French that if they gave aid to the rebels, they would be a real pain to the British, maybe even stripping away all of their colonies in North America and certainly draining a lot of wealth and resources away. Remember that idea of mercantilism, draining away their wealth, would inevitably help the French. Here you have a classic, the enemy of my enemy is my friend arrangement. At the time, France was the most autocratic monarchy in all of Europe. The American colonists were fighting to overthrow a monarch and install a republic. And yet, they both wanted to be the British. Benjamin Franklin had been in charge of arranging an alliance with France for a year, and he became the darling of the Parisian court. He intentionally dressed in very simple clothing, like he was fresh from the American frontier, including a raccoon-skin cap that he wore all around Paris, despite certainly never wearing these clothes when he was a wealthy guy in Philadelphia. After Saratoga, the British had to take stock of the situation. Howe was sitting in Philadelphia. Why wasn't he in Albany again? And the forces coming down from Canada had either retreated or been captured entirely. Parliament attempted to try some rather urgent diplomacy. They looked at all the prior demands and grievances from Congress, the ones they really hadn't looked at before this point, and agreed to essentially every one of them, if the colonists would give up this independent nonsense. despite this very friendly new approach, Paris was also being very, very friendly. Franklin did a masterful job letting the French know just how friendly the British were being. Listen, if you want the colonies to rebel, you better help us now, or we might just go back to being British again and probably at war with you. This seals the deal, and the Franco-American Treaty of 1778, France formally joined the war on America's side, recognized American independence, and formed a military alliance going forward that came with a lot of cash and weapons. Now, this little colonial revolution was part of a world war. By 1779, Holland and Spain have both joined in this war against Britain. We talked a few episodes ago about how these countries had previously fought wars against Britain, and they're very happy to attack in Britain's time of weakness. In 1780, Russia led a coalition of neutral nations who agreed not to trade with Britain, which doesn't sound terribly neutral. So, by keeping themselves from being defeated until 1778 and 1779, and winning a victory that the world all recognised, they had stalled until Britain was now at war with essentially everyone. Everyone that counted in European politics at the time. This meant that the actual fighting in North America was suddenly a minor distraction in the pile-on of nations attacking Britain. It was far more worrying when a bunch of countries on your doorstep all go to war with you than colonies 3,000 miles away. But in North America, the greatest military asset France could provide was its navy. Britain had been able to block colonial ports while moving their troops up and down the coast with total freedom. But the arrival of the French fleet took that advantage away. Supplying troops was suddenly very challenging. Howe was finally coaxed out of Philadelphia and returned to New York where he could be ensured supplies. He was pursued by Washington all the way to New York with several battles along the way. 6,000 French troops landed in Rhode Island, though initially there was a lot of friction between the colonials and the French. The French nobles were very confused by these officers with no noble breeding, who came from, at best, the middle class. We've mentioned him a few times, but it's around about this point that Benedict Arnold, who was feeling deeply unappreciated and upstaged by others, despite all his major victories, changed sides and helped the British. He was also in considerable debt and wanted a nice position in the British Army. Washington was stunned. He was completely convinced that Arnold was loyal, and was known to have said, "Whom can we trust now?" with the idea that Arnold, of all people, would turn on his back on him. He'd known Arnold's wife since she was young, and he was very close to the man. The British looked to try a new strategy and move from New York to Savannah, hoping for better success in the South, which had always been more loyal. Down there, the war became very savage, with colonial troops fighting a guerrilla campaign, hitting the British whenever they tried to move, attacking supply lines. This is the conflict that made famous Francis Marion, the Swamp Fox. Conflict stretched throughout the Carolinas, with victories of the British in most large battles, but constant losses in smaller conflicts. Throughout this, the colonial troops kept drawing the British general Cornwallis and his troops farther and farther away from his base, until eventually surrounding him and forcing him to retreat back again, all the while under fire. During all this, many of the native tribes took sides, but most of them sided with the British. It's not hard to understand this. After the end of the Seven Years' War, the Proclamation Line of 1763 had been designed to stop colonists coming into conflict with natives and taking their land. So we can't really be amazed they chose the British over the people they saw as trying to steal all their land. In fact, during the war, westward expansion picked up. Now the British were not there to stop them. Kentucky especially expanded during this time. Louisville, Kentucky is named after the French king in recognition of his alliance. In 1779, the four major Iroquois tribes that supported the British were forced to sign the Treaty of Fort Stanwyck. This is the first treaty between the native tribes and the new American nation, and in it, the natives were forced to forfeit basically all of their land. Man, I hope that isn't a model for all future treaties between the natives and the... While the colonial navy was limited, and mostly consisted of small squadrons that harassed the British, we should take a moment to talk about privateers. We've talked about privateers before. They're basically pirates that are loyal to only one country. The Americans hired a lot of them to raid British shipping and not raid their own shipping. However, it's worth noting that even as the French entered the war, the British are engaged all around the world by enemies, things are not necessarily going great for the colonials. Inflation in the colonies was completely out of control. Congress was forced to announce they would not be repaying the entirety of their debts and would actually only pay 2.5 cents on every dollar they owed somebody. Morale sunk. Ideas of national unity were collapsing. No one wanted to provide supplies to the colonial army. They wouldn't get paid. However, despite this, the end was in sight. Cornwallis in the south had moved to the Chesapeake region to try and get supplies to the British Navy. But the French Navy got there first. Washington and the French troops moved in and sealed them off in the Yorktown Peninsula, and slowly ground the British down through siege and lack of supplies until finally they surrendered, with only a few hundred casualties, avoiding any major battle and ensuring the lives of Cornwallis's men. Despite their major army being defeated, fighting would continue for another year, but Britain was stretched far too thin and had no more troops to spare to fight in North America. The British were forced to consider their situation. They were fighting in India, the West Indies, on the island of Menorca, Gibraltar, and they were just exhausted. When the Americans sent a delegation to Britain, they were told not to make a peace treaty on their own. They were supposed to sign a joint treaty with France. But one of the leading delegates was John Jay. John Jay was very suspicious of France. He felt they wanted America dependent and cooped up east of the Allegheny Mountains. So Jay made approaches to the British and cut a deal behind France's back. The final treaty was struck and included several important components. Firstly, the British would recognise American independence. Secondly, loyalists who fought for Britain would be left alone and the states were not states had to return any land or property that had been taken from them. P.S. That land was, you know, not returned and neither was the property, but it was a nice idea. And finally, and most importantly, the majority of the treaty was about fishing rights off Newfoundland. It always comes down to fish. Next episode, we'll look at this new nation. Who are they, and how on earth are they going to manage?